Welcome to part four of King Records, Cincinnati Legacy. I'm Lee Hay. On this program, you'll hear an analysis of Freddie King's influence on Eric Clapton, plus Albert King and Lonnie Max on Stevie Ray Vaughan. Darren Blaze will touch on the reasons for the lack of recognition of King Records, while Elliot Ruther offers up some efforts by the city of Cincinnati and others to step up recognition of King's legacy. Several musicians talk about their memories of King Records. Randy McNutt speaks with Sid Nathan's nephew about his uncle, plus more from a roundtable discussion of King moderated by Larry Nager. On King Records, Cincinnati Legacy, Part 4.
I'm Stuart Holman. I grew up in Cincinnati playing guitar as a young kid. I've been playing that guitar for 44 years now, and you may know a band in Cincinnati called Big City, which operated with a horn section and was about my third outfit with a horn section, and definitely tied to the motivation behind that was growing up in Cincinnati and the influence of the great horn sections of King Records. So I would like to point out the importance of the music out of King Records and the influence that it had on two of the absolutely predominant power guitar forces in pop and rock and roll and blues that have ever walked the planet, and those would be Eric Clapton and Stevie Ray Vaughan. Freddie King might possibly be considered Clapton's greatest influence. I know Eric always addresses Buddy Guy as his perhaps his most powerful influence, but if you listen to the early Freddie King and you listen to Clapton and compare notes, there's a remarkable similarity there. To the best of my knowledge, Freddie King's version of Hideaway, which has become the classic blues instrumental of all time, I think, was recorded at King in 1961. To the best of my knowledge, it appeared on his album entitled Let's Hide Away and Dance Away. keeping in mind that was 1961. 5 years later, in a world where information was not transported across the oceans anywhere near the way that it is today, one of the most influential blues albums of all time was released in England, which was John Mayall with Eric Clapton and the Blues Breakers. And if you haven't heard that, shame on you, and get out there and take a listen, because that is Clapton when he was young and hungry and undiscovered and absolutely searing on every single cut. The second cut on John Mayall with Eric Clapton and the Blues Breakers is Hideaway, and Clapton definitely notches up Freddie King's original version of that in just a totally searing rendition. Clapton over the years recorded numerous tunes that Freddie recorded early in his career, many of which appeared on King albums and releases, such things as Tore Down, a classic Have You Ever Loved a Woman, Going Down, Key to the Highway. Those were all tunes that Freddie recorded that Clapton has made standards in his repertoire, touring and so forth. Moving off Freddie King and Eric Clapton, I would like to address Stevie Ray Vaughan. Without question, his most powerful influence is Albert King. And not only was he an influence, but the two of them were very close, not only in style, but they were buds as well. When I first heard Albert's cut entitled Let's Have a Natural Ball, I was completely blown away. Playing blues guitar myself and being a student of Albert King, the Let's Have a Natural Ball, which was recorded at King in 1960, is totally off the map in terms of its intensity and its style. It's actually a bebop tune with a horn section. And Albert, again, he's kind of in the young and hungry stage himself and is absolutely searing on that cut, and it's really worth a listen. just an amazing, amazing piece of work. Lonnie Mack was also, as we all know, was a tremendous influence on Stevie Ray, and they did some recording together and played together many live shows and so forth, and we know the influence that that Lonnie had there, and the fact that Lonnie was, again, a totally creative stylist coming out of Cincinnati and King Records with Memphis and Wham and many of the cuts that he did in the early days is a feather in King's cap as well. Again, horn section, horn section, horn section. The whole genre of playing rhythm and blues and adding a horn section was greatly ramped up by the early days at King Records.
Well, I'm told down, I'm almost level with the ground. Well, I'm told down, I'm almost level with the ground. To jump in, my baby showed up and said, I will tell you when. Well, I'm told on, I'm almost level with the ground. Whoa, I feel like this when my baby can be found. I love you, baby, with all my heart and soul. A love like mine will never grow old. I love you in the morning and in the evening too. But every time you leave me, I get mad with you. Well, I'm told on, I'm almost level with the ground. Ooh, I feel like this when my baby can't be found. A love like mine is out of sight. I lie for you if you want me to. I really don't believe your love is true. Well, I'm told out, I'm almost level with the ground. Oh, I feel like this when my baby can't be found. Well, I'm told out, I'm almost level.
My name is Darren Blaze. I think one reason why King isn't on the same level as Sun and all those, you know, early Atlantic and Stax, its leader dies. He dies and the company essentially comes to an end with him. There's nobody to kind of carry the torch. There's no charismatic icon guy like a Sam Phillips or whatever. I mean, up until we died, Sam Phillips would be on the David Letterman show once a year. So there was never anybody to get out there and talk about what they did. I mean, everybody's their best promoter is themselves, especially in music. So through that whole time, I think it was kind of like the perfect storm. King was doing one very specific kind of music, which was funk and really gruff-styled R&B of what they did well.
Minute man,
yeah, 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 yeah.
If you don't believe I'm all I say, come up here and take my hand. When I let you go, you'll cry. Oh yes, he's a 60-minute man. There'll be 15 minutes of kissing. Then you holler, please don't stop.
Don't stop.
There'll be 50 minutes teasing and 50 minutes squeezing and 50 minutes of blowing my top. If your old man ain't treating you right, come up and see old Dan. I'll rock 'em, roll 'em all night long. I'm a 60-minute man.
60-minute
man.
Then you holler, please don't stop.
There'll be 50 minutes of teasing and 50 minutes of squeezing and 50 minutes of blowing my top. If your old man ain't treating you right, come up and see old Dan. I'll rock 'em, roll 'em all night long. I'm a 60-minute man, oh yeah.
At that same time, Motown is moving in. A more northern soul-style version is becoming popular that's more easily sold to young white kids. And King did produce a lot of great northern soul stuff, whether it's Cody Black or Junior McCant. Those artists are among the great northern soul singers. But King didn't really know how to promote those records. There is much more of a focus of the music industry moving to Nashville, New York, and L.A., and here they are in Cincinnati. So it's just kind of a bunch of things all kind of coming together. But I mean, when you go back and you look at some of the stuff that they were producing during the decline, especially recently with some of the stuff that Ace has put out. It's incredible. It holds up against any Motown or anything else. Those Janie McCant records are $3,000 because they didn't sell, so they scrapped them all. And now they're being recognized as these absolute classics. Motown have been recognized if Berry Gordy had died and kind of faded off into the background? Would Sun be recognized? You know, you got to remember that they tore down Stax Records. The city of Memphis allowed the original Stax Records to be torn down. And then they built a museum right on top of it. You know, so, you know, Cincinnati isn't the only one guilty in it. And we're all, you know, as a country, we don't celebrate the contributions of the people that started it. So I think it's more of a class issue where it's the cultural contributions of poor whites and poor blacks, and really, who cares about them in a city where we celebrate the triumphs of Procter & Gamble and the blue chip stocks? And I think Cincinnati has always had an identity problem of really seeing what they are about and trying to set themselves apart from something that they just are. You know, I just always have seen King as black and white culture together in an environment that was naturally friendly and was commercial. Everybody was there to make money. You know, nobody realized. Everybody was just working to get paid. I would be interested to talk to some of those day-to-day workers that drove through the burned-out Avondale to get to work, to go work with white people, or white people driving through burned-out Avondale to go work at King. So there's a lady, she lived in Delhi. Her name was Beatrice. She went by B. She worked in the payroll department at King. And I went to see her one day, and she for some reason had all these pay stubs. I'm going through them, and I'm just like flipping through them. And it's, you know, Johnson and blah, 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 and all these names. And then just one after the other, probably 75 to 100 in a row, are all these Japanese names. And I was just like, what is that about? And she's like, I don't know. For some reason, we had a bunch of Japanese people working there at one point. A friend of mine who was a Quaker was telling me about the Quaker peace movement during World War II and how the Quaker houses in Cincinnati brought in a bunch of Japanese people who had been moved from the West Coast for threats against national security and were all moved into the Midwest and everything. And then calling her back and asking a couple more questions and then slowly figuring out that one of the Quaker houses was on the bus route from the Quaker house to King. So they got them all jobs at King and they just worked in the factories to like packing boxes and pressing records and stuff like that. And then they're there for like 3 years and then everybody moves back to the West Coast. You know, so that's like, I think like the first Japanese person that is a resident of Cincinnati is the guy that introduces Oriental glazing to Rookwood pottery and stuff like that. And, you know, and then later here you have 50 years, 75 years later, you have all these Japanese guys working, pressing American R&B records. You know, what a snapshot of history. You're either going to move to the Midwest or we're going to put you in a detention center in Arizona.
Hey, this is Brian Lovely, Cincinnati music dude, member of the Faux Frenchman, talking about King Records. I've been in Cincinnati my entire adult life playing music, and I haven't been around long enough to have played with really any of the people at King, aside from maybe Kenny Poole. But I know the R&B and groove DNA that's firmly implanted in this city is certainly, I've certainly come in contact with playing a lot of R&B in this town. But really just being a member of Planet Earth, and having lived when I did, the music at King Records radiated out. I mean, I grew up in New Hampshire, and songs like Big 10-inch Record, which of course were covered by my favorite Boston band, Aerosmith, and on and on, you know, Hank Ballard, Billy Ward, all these people were giants, certainly laid the groundwork for all the Devil's music that I enjoyed playing.
No, she doesn't want me.
George Cunningham of the Faux Frenchman, and I grew up in the Detroit area in the 60s, and it was I can relate to this King stuff not only because I love the music in kind of a retrospective kind of way. People like Johnny Guitar Watson and Little Willie John and those, you know, just the Delmore Brothers, the list is endless, obviously. But I also dig the fact that you grow up with this feeling like your town is something special. There's this really, you know, special thing that's happening just around the corner from where you live. And in the 60s, of course, in Detroit, you had all these great Motown hits being turned out. And Cincinnati obviously had that in the 50s and into the 60s as well, with all these great, great artists recording for King Records.
This is Bob Nave. I wanted to talk a little bit about my remembrances and involvement with King Records. King Records was an absolute institution here in Cincinnati. I was looking through my 45 collection to see what were some of the first King Records that I purchased. And I think the first one was a recording of Bill Doggett called Honky Tonk. I was playing in a band at the time, and we had a saxophone player, and we decided to learn that tune, so we had to have a record to learn it, having heard it on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I also found some 45s by Hank Ballard, the Midnighters. Freddie King, who originally recorded on a subsidiary label called Federal. Of course, James Brown. James Brown, to my way of thinking, really made the label the giant that it was. I got a call one Saturday morning from Kenny Poole, who was actually in the studio, and they were doing a session for James Brown. And he said, so-and-so, the organ player, didn't show up. Can you come down? And I was living near Oxford, Ohio at the time. I said, it'll take me about an hour to get there. So when I got there, it was in progress, and I was very nervous, and I was very excited to be invited to participate in the James Brown session. And James was running around like a madman. He was, you know, play this line, boop, da, 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 play the bass line. And why they called me, because James could play organ. He was a pretty decent organ player. I mean, but I guess he wanted to spend his focus and energy on building the tracks to this, you know, whatever we were doing. We just played little vamps. And then apparently what would happen, he had have these tracks recorded, and he would sit and listen to them and sort of splice things together and then write lyrics and add horns, and that became a finished product. I don't know if any of that stuff ever made it to vinyl or not, but I was very nervous, and it was a short session because I got there about midway through, so my participation was only, you know, maybe an hour, something like that. In 1966, 2 years before Sid Nathan died, the band I was in at the time, the Lemon Pipers, went into King to record what was to be, I think, a demo that we were going to shop to record companies to try to, you know, get a recording contract. And I was trying to remember how that all came together, and I can't. I can't remember who arranged it or who paid for it or what. I just remember that we did it, and I still have a reel-to-reel copy of that session. What I remember about the interior of the King facility, it was dark. It was cluttered. The studio was a very large room, and it was kind of dark yellow, light brown, a lot of, shall we say, cigarette smoke-stained acoustic tile. They had a Hammond B3 there, which was really an invitation for me to play because I always wanted to play one, never had one at that time. The control room was kind of above the studio. It wasn't on the same level. You had to kind of go up some steps to get into the control room. I was in there briefly, and at that time they were using Ampex reel-to-reel tape machines, 8-track, and the board was pretty crude, as I recall, but they got some amazing sound out of that studio.
Well, on my motor to roll. You got to cruise with me smooth, slow, and easy. Smooth, slow, and easy. Smooth, slow, and easy. Oh, man, when I won't let me go. Well, when you're pulling in the station, baby, don't forget to check on my tank. You better see if my motor need a tune-up job. And don't forget my drink. You got to cruise with me smooth, slow. Cruise them in smooth and easy. Cruise them is smooth and easy. Smooth, slow, and easy. Smooth, slow, and easy. Oh, man, when I won't let me go.
I think it's unfortunate that the city of Cincinnati and others in the music industry have not done a more proper job of recognizing King Records for what it was and Sid Nathan for who he was and what he built. It was quite an institution in its day, and I think that for those who had an opportunity to participate one way or another were somehow blessed by it all.
Hi, my name is Elliot Ruther. I'm a musician born and raised here in Cincinnati. It's an honor to be able to speak on the subject of King Records and the town's history of music that I look to for as much inspiration as I can. With all the decades that King put and all the musical genres that it has done, there's plenty of inspiration to last a lifetime. And while I was working for John Cranley, we talked a lot about this story and why we want to do something to help raise awareness or bring attention as we were going through the learning process of this. And with 3 decades of recordings and millions of records, there's so much to learn from. Soon afterwards, a gentleman by the name of Marvin Hawkins joined in the Cranley office. Marvin's a musician. You may know him in town from Marvin and the Experience. So he and I started hitting it off and exploring those different influences within the office. And Cranley said to go ahead and do some things, see what kind of interest is there. Let's try to raise attention. And at that point, we kind of, you know, kicked off a little bit of an awareness-raising campaign to listen to people's stories. We took in like hundreds of calls in the council office and wrote down these stories and make connections with some of the King recording artists, most notably Mr. Bootsy Collins, and continue to connect on different opportunities to celebrate and look to preserve this history in a way that is fresh and current. A couple years back, Mr. Collins began a recording project, just filming King alum, talking about their experience to document this. A couple years back, the Mayerson Foundation, led by Neil Mayerson with Retta Cooper, put together an incredible CD to benefit folks with disabilities through the Inclusion Network. There were King recording artists like Bootsy and Mr. Philip Paul, who played along with folks like Peter Frampton and Ed Cunningham, and that effort really raised a lot of attention and awareness. We'll be right back.
hit it.
There's been actually quite a number of things that have happened, but there's so much to go. And you start looking at what does it mean to put a plaque on the old building, which is a business that is operating today. Is that enough? Do you want to just put a plaque on the building when there's just these decades and all this history that is there? Well, there's been communication and interest with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, with Larry Nager and the Cammy Awards. You know, Terry Stewart came down from, he's the president of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he spoke to the fact that there are three cities that he sees that where rock and roll began, one being Memphis, one being New Orleans, and the third being Cincinnati.
This is Randy McNutt, and I'm talking with Stephen Halper. Steve is the son of Dorothy and Saul Halper, the original investors in King Records, along with some other friends and family. Steve, one thing I'm very interested in is how King came about. You were telling me a story. There wouldn't be a King Records if not for the 1937 flood in Cincinnati.
That's right. If it wasn't for two tragic events, the 1937 flood and World War II, there wouldn't be a King Record. And the reason for that is in 1937, the flood caused places to flood up and down the river. And my father, who fixed radios, TVs, and jukeboxes and pinball machines, was asked by a man who had those kinds of machines up and down the river, he was asked to go fix them. And he did in 1937. Well, the cost for him doing that was $6. Because it was a depression, the man could not pay him. And sometime after 1937, he came into my dad's store, which was actually a photography store, and said to Saul, he said, "Saul, look, I can't pay you, but I've got these records. If you just take these records and put them on a table, people will buy them and you'll get your money back." My dad really didn't want to do that, but he did because it was his only choice. And the records sold quickly and he made more than the $6. Seeing that, he went into the record business, and Sid Nathan, who was his brother-in-law, saw the same thing. They both had little shops for photography. They both opened up just retail record stores. Sid's Records was one, I think, and then Halper's Records. Well, they were doing pretty good, and then the war came. When World War II came, there was a shortage of supplies. Everything was in short because all the supplies went to the war effort. And the vinyl that they made records out of also was in short supply. So there weren't that many records. There were more people who were selling them that needed them than there were. So when you went to the distributor, they wanted money under the table. Well, my Uncle Sid, who founded King Record, he was not about to pay off anybody. So he went to Chicago with my father to talk to the main company. And he went there and they said, "We know what's going on, but there's nothing we can do about it. You either have to pay him or you're not going to get the records." So Sid, being the person he was, on the way back, he says, "I'll make my own records." From nothing, he started just having recordings. I think his first artist was Grandpa Jones. And then from that, he got money from relatives. And that money was used to plant the seeds for the King Record on Brewster Avenue. And then one thing led to another. And that's how King Record was born.
Tell me your memories of your uncle.
Let me describe my Uncle Sid. Of course, I loved him very much. He was about 5'4". He weighed anywhere from 180 to 250 pounds. Always was very heavy, always had health problems. He had asthma. He had very bad eyesight, wore Coke bottle glasses, and was known for always smoking a cigar. And I can remember him getting up in the morning and having a cigar in his mouth. But he was a big-hearted person and would do anything for anybody. Sid had a knack for seeing, I guess, what some other people didn't see or weren't really interested in being in that business at first. And he knew, and he always used to say that the most important part of his business was not the records, but was the publishing. And so he had a large catalog of great songs where King Records, under various names, owned songs that were classics.
This is dedicated to the one I love. While I'm away from you, my baby, I know it's hard for you, my baby.
especially for me. And it's something that everybody needs. Each night before you go to bed, my baby, whisper a little prayer for me, my baby, and let's tell all the stars above that this is dedicated to the one I
say that he could find artists. That wasn't really a hard or difficult thing to do. It was finding artists who could create music and write music, or people who could do that. That was the real talent, and he was always looking for people who could do both write and perform.
After Sid's death, the investors, what did they feel when Sid died? Did they probably didn't want to run the company anymore and decided to sell, or... What was the thoughts at that point? Did your parents ever talk about that?
Yeah. Well, actually, what happened was this. Sid bought out my parents, bought their interest out before he died. He also bought pretty much the other investors out over a number of years. And so he was basically the only owner. David, his brother, may have still had an interest. I'm not sure one way or the other. But it was basically Sid's company at the time of his death. Sid had one son, Nat, who has also passed away. Nat was not a person capable of taking over this ship. So when Sid died, really, there was nobody to take it over. When Sid died, my mother, my uncle, and Sid's lawyer acted as trustees over this asset, and it had to be sold because there was no one to run it. So that's why it was sold, I think, a couple years later. I did want to tell you one other interesting thing is about a guy named Seymour Stein. Seymour Stein later became much more successful financially, I think, than Sid ever was. He started a record company in New York, and he became president of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And he's really the reason that Sid got into the Hall of Fame. He pushed Sid's name over and over again to the people who make those decisions, and eventually he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Seymour Stein, when he was about 15 or 16, came from New York and spent about a year with Sid, followed him around and learned the record business. And so that was very interesting. That was like in the late 50s or early 60s, I think.
Yes, Seymour Stein went on to found Sire Records and discover Madonna and the whole thing.
So, right, right.
Yeah. I really appreciate you stopping to talk about it, your uncle and King Records, and anything else you'd like to add.
I just want to thank you on behalf of my family that you and Lee and Bootsy Collins and his wife and other people in the city are doing everything they can to recognize what King Record did. It wasn't just Sid Nathan or wasn't my parents. It was a whole cadre of people who created something that we should all try to remember. And thanks to those efforts, and that will take place. So I thank
so.
You on behalf of our family.
Thank you, Steve.
This is Larry Nager. So one of our guests is Juanita Paul, Phil's wife, and a Cincinnati entertainer in her own right.
I wanted to say that the people in Evanston, they do not know anything about King Records. They don't even know my husband. He walks down the street, they don't know him.
Philip Hall.
No, they don't know him. And it's always a mystery. So
and the musicians know. You know, it starts with the other musicians. And rock musicians know all about King. They know all about Phil. You know, it's one of those things as a Cincinnatian. You know who Pete Rose is, right? Even
sure.
if you don't like baseball,
certainly.
You know who Pete Rose is.
Certainly.
You know who Boomer Esiason is, even if you don't like football.
Right.
So Philip Hall is as much a Cincinnati hero, as much a Cincinnati All-Star. Otis Williams is as much a Cincinnati All-Star. as these guys. And it should be as part and parcel of people's Cincinnati consciousness as Johnny Bench, as Pete Rose, as Boomer Esiason. The idea of it, again, we're not doing this for the right reason. You know, we don't have to do this because we're good people and we need to shine a light on this and it's just the right thing to do. It's the best thing to do for Cincinnati.
Yeah.
It shows Cincinnati in the light in which it would like to be shown as an exciting, happening creative. The creative class, we've got the creative class sitting around this table right now, and it's not generational. There has been a creative class in Cincinnati since before Mamie Smith stood in front of that horn, because there weren't microphones back then when she was recording. Mm-hmm. She was singing into a big horn. So maybe it's the river, you know, that you get into these river city things. There's been a vital creativity in this city, and it came to fruition at its peak at King Records with bluegrass and country and jazz and rhythm and blues and rock and roll and rockabilly and funk. You look at so many cities and the way they struggle to get this identity, the way Cleveland out of nowhere built the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the way Memphis had to literally rebuild Beale Street and rebuild Stax Records. We have a legacy here. We have a heritage here. It's a living legacy. There are human beings that can still speak about it, and we're wasting it. We're wasting time. We're wasting something the city cannot afford to waste, which is a really positive image that cuts across racial lines. It cuts across musical genres. It cuts across cultures. It cuts across languages. King Records is an international language. Yeah. It's spoken all over the world, but it's not spoken here in Cincinnati. In Cincinnati, it's a dead language, and it's time to put a stop to it and stop debating it and stop sitting on our thumbs and get this thing moving, because it's ours to lose, and we're losing it.
Yes. Agreed. Agreed.
Yeah. I'm Larry Nager, and I want to thank Otis Williams, Juanita Paul, and Keith Little, and Rufus Allen, and J.J. Peterson, and Jimmy Raley, and Philip Paul.
This has been part 4 of King Records, Cincinnati Legacy. King Records is an integral chapter of Cincinnati's history and must be recognized. The musicians who played there and their music must not be forgotten. King Records, Cincinnati Legacy was produced in the studio of WVXU in Cincinnati. Technical assistance from Darren Blaze and Shake It Records. I'm Lee Hay.